friends. Now that your television set is on, it is my job to talk to you, and you are to listen. If you finish before I do, let me know. Sometimes there are great tasks and energy spent, great tasks done, and then there is no audience. I heard of a man once who, celebrating his birthday, decided to order a 10-layer cake. He went to the baker, explained how one layer was to be on top of the other, and at the top was to be the initial of his last name, the letter S. So the baker worked at it for about a week. The man came back to take a look at the cake. It was really a masterpiece. But the purchaser said, "There's only one thing I don't like about it, and that is that you have a Gothic S at the top of the cake. I would like a block S." The baker said, "Well, I can do that very quickly in 20 minutes. So 20 minutes later, he had the block S on the cake. And he said to the man who was having the birthday, "Where shall I send it?" "Oh," he says, "don't send it. I'll eat it here." The title of this telecast, is The Invisible Gardener. I will tell you what it's about. We give titles sometimes that are a little vague or make you think. The title actually means an undercurrent that is going on in this world that'll give us a little hope. It's the undercurrent of mysticism. Just as in Africa, under the sands, there are great waters flowing. So too, despite all of our secularity, conflicts, schisms, hatreds, and so forth, there's something good, something alive. It is not very evident, although I've noticed in the past week I was with two university groups, and both mentioned this idea that I'm to give to you. They saw it. It's not on the surface. The prodigal son, when he left home, was right in being hungry. He was wrong and living on husks. So our young people, many others today, are living on husks. But they're hungry. And they're hungry for the spirit. Now I know perhaps what is running through your mind, but isn't there today dominant in all of our thinking the death of God, eclipse of God? Listen. There's no such thing as an eclipse of the sun. There's an eclipse of the sun, it's because there's some other object between the sun and us. God is the sun, there's no eclipse in him. Maybe we've got mud packs over our Grant, the sun is mysterious too, just like God is. The sun is so bright you can't look at it. And yet, in the light of that one thing that you can't see, everything else is quite visible. great, clear, wonderful world. Due to that one unseen mystery, you can see the moon. And you can see things under the moon. But the moon is the mother of lunatics. So despite any contrary appearances, there is an invisible gardener. Just suppose some explorers, say in Africa, had been going through the bush and the woods and the forests, and finally came to a great clearing of land. On this cleared land, they discovered plots of flowers. Different species, different kinds, different colors, and all laid out properly, with various geometric designs. These explorers would say, wonder how all this order got here, this beauty. Oh, they said, there must be some invisible gardener here. And the explorers decided to watch. They watched, but no one came. So they put up a wire fence. No one came. They thought, well, he must be sneaking in, so they electrified the fence. And still, they could not explain the plot. That's why we've called this the invisible gardener. Because beneath all of this superficial secularity, there is the search for something transcendent. Now, let me go through just a number of quick little indications of this hidden, mystical undercurrent. First of all, I've already mentioned in another telecast, or will mention, one or the other, the use of psychedelic drugs. Young people take psychedelic drugs, first of all, because they're disgusted with the world. Secondly, they want some immediate contact with something outside of the world. Well, they choose a rather stupid way to do it, namely a chemical which merely rearranges the images of the subconscious, makes them passive. And one never does anything good when he's wholly passive. You have to be active. But the very fact that they're looking for an escape and are taking these fleeting, contradictory images, which ruin their minds eventually, is an indication that they're searching for something else. Scientists, too. They're telling us that all they can do is merely bring us to the edge of the picture. They can tell us nothing of the author. Arthur Eddington, one of the great physical scientists of our times, ends up his book on the nature of the physical universe with a chapter on mysticism. Can you imagine a scientist of the 19th century ever doing that? Then take art. Even the craziest of modern art. Art where you can't tell whether it's a drunken man going up a stairs or a stairs going up a drunken man. But what is there in this kind of abstraction? There is a recognition of the fact that the concrete order does not satisfy. So there's an appeal to something subjective. It's a kind of a trap for meditation. Something good in that. Not very long ago, Rabbi Hertzberg, professor of history at Columbia University, said, I'm getting tired of all this scurrying about relevance. In other words, all the talk about getting involved socially. Sure, he says there must be that. But he says, I'm finding, too, that many of the clerics that are going into the world are making the world a worse mess than it was before. The Wall Street Journal commented on it and said, isn't the purpose of religion to give us something transcendent? To bring us love and understanding, both of God and neighbor? See, even the complaints that are made, even I might say and add, the criticism against institutional and formalized religion is what? It's a desire for something more spiritual. In other words, the religion must not become so institutionalized, so formalized, that it's lost the spirit. And thus, we might even invoke dramas. Novelists. See how many of them are going into myths? Myths taken from the apocalypse? Myths taken from the crucifixion? As religion gives up myths, the dramatists and the novelists are picking it up. Almost uncanonical witnesses to the spirit and to mysticism. As Cale Young Rice put it, if I can remember his poetry, there is a quest that haunts me. In nights when I am alone, the need to ride where the ways divide, the known from the unknown, I mount what thought is near me, and soon I reach the place, the tenuous rim where the seen grows dim and the sightless hides its face. I have ridden the winds, I have ridden the seas, I have ridden the moon and stars, I have set my feet in the stirrup seat of a comet coursing Mars. And lo, everywhere, through earth and air, my thoughts speed lightning shod, till they come to a place where checking pace they cry, beyond lies God. So I'm not appealing to the more traditional forms, I'm appealing to the untraditional forms to indicate that there is a mystical yearning in our civilization which is indeed very consoling. Now, what is mysticism? Well, there will be some that will not like this definition. It's not too traditional. Let's see, I have 10 minutes and 25 seconds to develop it. You thought I had an hour and a half, didn't you? I know, that's the way these telecasts are. They always seem longer than they are. I remember once being told by a steward on a transatlantic liner, he said, I remember the sermon, he said, you preached in St. Patrick's Cathedral on the missions. He said, my, that was a wonderful talk. Wonderful. He said, I enjoyed every minute of that hour and a quarter. I said, my good man, I never talked an hour and a quarter in my life. Well, he said, it seemed that long to me. Now, what is mysticism? Mysticism is intersection. It's an intersection. I might develop that it's the intersection of time and the timeless, but I will not have time for that. It's an intersection of something else. It's an intersection of the old word, the contemplative and the active. Now, what we have had, this is a new definition of mysticism, really, when you put the active in. Because through history, the mystics have always just been contemplatives. For example, at the beginning of Christianity, the monks went into the desert, get away from the devil, get away from cities. Then we had monasteries, where monks withdrew from the world give themselves over to contemplation. This mysticism of which I'm speaking, I think, is something new. It's the combination of both. What we have here with those who write about the secular city and those who are seeking involvement and relevancy and so forth are taking merely the active. What would be the model? Well, the model might be the mount of the Transfiguration. This Transfiguration scene, remember, was one in which our Blessed Lord went up into the mountain with three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John. While there, he became transfigured. If you put an electric light inside of an alabaster vase, if it were cheap, it would be a vase. You put an electric light inside of an alabaster vase, and it will glow. Well, when you put divinity inside of humanity, humanity will glow. Probably the natural state of our Blessed Lord was that of the alabaster vase so illuminated. But in any case, at this moment, he did let the Shekinah, the glory, the effulgence, shine through his humanity so that his face was like the sun and his garments white as snow. And this mount here was one that so much charmed Peter, James, and John that Peter spoke and he said, let's stay here. This is marvelous. Let's build three tabernacles here. One for Moses, one for Elias, one for thee. He wanted to make permanent this transfiguration, really this transient glory. But what happened? This is the contemplation. The Lord took him down the mount. They went from the mountain top or peak down into the valley. What did they find in the valley? Found a young boy that was out of his mind. Idiotic and crazy. They found a distraught father. They found skeptical intelligentsia. And they found some of the unbelieving disciples that had been left behind when they went up into the mount. In other words, the Lord was saying, listen, if you have a light, if you've been given an endowment, you have a moment of effulgence, get down into the world, down into the valley, down where there's pain, down where there's insanity, down where there's need, down where there's poverty. This is your mission. And I believe that this is the mysticism of the 20th century, not just men that will indulge themselves in active life. Why? Because the only love they have to give is their own. And it's poor, it's tawdry. That's why they never do any great good. The men of the future will be men who have communed here with the authentic life and then have brought it down into the muck and the mess of the world. And they're 1,000 times more active than those who pride themselves on being so active. This was the vocation of Moses. Moses was 40 years a shepherd. Just tending sheep, and then comes the mission. Go to your people. Lead them out. Go to the king. Moses then had to go through the desert. But he was prepared for it. You would be surprised at how often moments of this kind happen in the world. I think in every single life there comes one moment, at least one moment of this kind, to every single person. It's brief, it's transient, it's immediate, but it's enough to carry them through life if they only realize it. And you will find its effectiveness sometimes where you'd never suspect it. Riding a New York subway one day, alongside of me sat a great big Negro man. He was about 6'4", a tremendous hulk with a big black sweater. You know what he was doing? He was knitting. Knitting. I tell you, of all incongruities, it was to see this great giant of a man with two tiny little needles and a ball of wool down in a paper bag. I couldn't resist it. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm knitting a sweater for my son." But he says, "That's not the only thing I do." He said, "I also read a great deal." Do you know what he pulled out of his bag? The writings of the great mystic, St. John of the Cross. Now get this bigger surprise still. I said, "What do you do?" He said, "I'm a longshoreman." There was a man who was carrying into his work the same vision of the transcendent. This is the mysticism of the future. We are not tending toward it yet sufficiently because we're too much involved. And we who are supposed to be leading the ways of holiness are not necessarily leading others along that path. So that those who occupy the front of the stage are merely the activists. But their influence will pass for the reason that I gave. They have not enough to give. Stomachs may be well fed, but not their spirit. They have only their own breath. They're not aflame and ablaze with love. So there's hope. Great hope. And this can be a great, big, wide, wonderful world. Just as soon as more, like this longshoreman, will communicate with what is divine. In other words, there is the invisible gardener in every soul, once in a lifetime. To everyone, many times to some, but he's there. And this is the beginning of the new mysticism of the 20th century. Did you know that I had given you in the 24 minutes and 20 seconds, whatever it is that I'm allowed, only one third of what I intended to give you? I guess it's because you're so pleasant. I just got wrapped up in one point, forgot the other two, but we'll come back again. Tell you more about it some other time. Thanks for listening. Bye, and God love you.